guardian of the universe, simply to get the forces of evil, the powers of this man,
all of us to be
complete tall buildings and cities. Up in the sky.
Is it a bird?
Is it a plane?
A mailman by day.
Cities, guardian by night.
Defending the citizens of New York.
For centuries, the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. World's mightiest mortal.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of near Earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it kick-ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
You don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess they didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
And get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Kick Ass 2, released August 16th, 2013, budget of $28 million, with a box office gross of $60.8 million, and this was directed by Jeff Wadlow. All right, boys, we lost Matthew Vaughn in the director's chair, but he found a suitable hand-picked replacement. The guy who made Never Back Down and Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. Oh, I see no way this could go wrong.
Not only that, there are a lot of things that are wrong with 2020, a lot of disastrous things. One of the biggest things, though, is Blumhouse's remake of Fantasy Island. I don't know if you guys have watched that.
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yes. Oh, my God. It was one of the last things released before the actual pandemic hit.
I was going to. Then I saw the trailer.
You were going to watch that?
Sure. A horror.
And then he did a movie I actually watched to prepare for this. He did a movie called Imaginary about a kid's imaginary friend, also by Blumhouse, by the way. It has the bear on the cover of it. People have seen that. This guy does not have a very good track record. So I don't know what Matthew Vaughn saw in this dude. He is also, by the way, Katie Couric's nephew. That's a thing.
That's it.
Well,
that's what we call having connections means you can continuously fail.
Correct. So this cat does not have a good track record. Of course, this track record we're talking about was years after this movie. But still, maybe he's one of these guys who was a good prodigy, good film student, and they saw a future in him. But Jesus Christ, not a very good handpicked successor, especially after last week's film and how innovative that last week's film was, at least in my eyes. I cannot imagine how this guy got this gig.
In the 3 years between movies, the landscape of comic book movies changed dramatically. Said goodbye to Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy the year before. We saw the Avengers finally come to fruition. And this came out the same summer as universally loved movies like Man of Steel and Iron Man 3. So there was clearly a market for wholesome, albeit divisive superhero movies in 2013, which 2013 might as well have been the cinematic equivalent of a war zone, because you could not go to the multiplex, post about a movie, and give your thoughts without getting into some kind of argument with somebody.
Yeah, that was
boy, have things changed.
Yeah, that was around the time Matt, you and I became friends.
Garrett and I almost re-broke up over Iron Man 3.
We did. Yeah, we broke up.
Stay tuned.
That's going to be coming up. 2013, goddamn. Every time you turned around, there was a new trailer being released, and then there was a new fucking war on the internet about comic book film. That was really starting around that
time. I mean, it went all the way to Star Trek, so there were plenty of... Even stuff like The Lone Ranger, you know, four people who went to go see it. I think I'm one of the four that saw it.
I saw it, too.
He also had The Wolverine come out this summer, so we were getting a different... A good mix. There was anticipation for this, to be sure, but let's talk about, as we alluded to earlier, Jeff Wadlow was Matthew Vaughn's handpicked replacement, because Matthew Vaughn, since Kick-Ass, had gone on to do X-Men First Class. He left Days of Future Past, and he was starting work on Kingsman.
Well, so he either left or got kicked off, depending on who you ask.
I think it's a mix of both.
I think, too.
Yeah, I think someone was desperate to get back to that franchise and kicked him out.
At least they kept a lot of his ideas. It's not like they started the movie from scratch. But Wadlow was Vaughn's handpicked replacement. And around the time, it took a couple years for this to actually be greenlit by Universal. Both Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Grace Moretz said, yep, we'll come back. And much like the first one, there was a comic to adapt. Now, this takes from two separate runs. There was a Hit Girl miniseries that a lot of this plot is borrowed from, as well as the actual Kick-Ass 2 volume, neither of which I have read, to be honest.
Same here. I've only read the first comic.
Yeah, still haven't read any of these.
Let me also say, I did not really care one way or the other about Kick-Ass 2. I was kind of indifferent, because I think the first one's broadly fine, but I would not have been one of the people, even though it leaves the door wide open for a sequel, if they never made one, I would not have felt like I was missing out on some thing I was dying to go see.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's something in that first one. Not only does it tell a story, it's mostly self-contained, but as a meta piece of commentary on comics, on comic book movies, on just that type of genre, it did its job. And doing a sequel would almost feel, I don't want to say it takes away from the original. I don't believe sequels take away from the original works, but it almost proves the meta points by continuing on.
Well, you run into the risk of becoming the very thing you were satirizing.
Yes. Yeah, and making a sequel to satire is a very, very difficult thing. It's almost impossible, actually. And if you're going to do this, last week had the breakout of Hit Girl. You base the whole movie around that, and we're going to discuss this movie when we do, but I think the title character plays background to his own film.
Well, that's part of the thought of doing a second one, is because even though it's 3 years later, they, I don't want to say they cut corners, but this is why Warner Brothers, almost by obligation, had to do a Harry Potter movie every year, because kids age at a really quick rate. All right, well, I'll talk about the timeline once we get into the movie, because massive questions with how that's handled. But they could not do an immediate sequel because Chloe Grace Moretz had visibly aged. So you couldn't do this, like, say, 6 months after. People would laugh. They'd be like, "This is there's no freaking way this is," even though the story, by how it's set up, really should be much more immediate than it actually is.
Now, was last week's film Universal, or did they switch hands in between? I thought it was Lionsgate, right?
Well, this one was Universal, and I think the first one was also Universal. Yeah, it was Universal, but Lionsgate was also a distributor.
Okay.
It was Lionsgate distribution in America, strictly Universal in the UK.
Gotcha.
Speaking of Lionsgate, the question was, not only did you lose Matthew Vaughn, but Nicolas Cage, I think, was also a vital aspect of the first movie. And I got to be honest, I had no interest really in this based on the trailers. But then I realized Jim Carrey was in this, and we'll talk about his involvement. But in a way, that was kind of a bigger get than Nicolas Cage, because Nicolas Cage picks his scripts by dartboard, especially around the 2010s. But Jim Carrey, we are very removed from when he was the biggest movie star in the world.
Big time. I remember being pretty shocked. In fact, I don't even think I knew he was in it when I went to see this. I didn't see any trailers or anything for it when I went. And like I said last week, I actually sent to review it. So I had no clue that Jim Carrey was in this until after the movie was over.
And for me, like, I never saw either of these. I just never had a desire. I remember seeing a trailer and thinking, that guy looks like Jim Carrey. And then I was like, oh, he's replacing Nicolas Cage. Okay, I guess if you're going to out Nicolas Cage, you're going to get Jim Carrey. That was just my thought process behind it, based on never seeing it until I got ready to do it for now. But I'm going to say, I think we get a different kind of Jim Carrey than we are really used to seeing. And maybe we could have used him last week.
Well, Jim Carrey's a weird dude. When this was being filmed, of course, he agreed to the script, shot it, but in the time between this thing was shot and actually distributed, he all of a sudden got a wild hair up his ass after one of the shootings. I believe it was, what was it, Parkland?
Sandy Hook.
All of a sudden, he decided he didn't like the violence in this movie, and he was not going to promote it in one way or another, which got Chloe Grace Moretz fucking pissed off, because she's like, you did this movie. Why aren't you helping us sell it? It was a really weird situation, and it was something that last week's movie took people by surprise. This one's coming out and people had already had their knives out. And here comes one of the biggest stars in the world, as Matt said, coming out against it. And I really do think that hurt the film in the long run.
Well, I do think it was a huge detriment to the film box office wise. However, I am never going to oppose someone for honestly feeling the way that they do if they could back it up. And I'll say, usually this type of shit is purely for theater. He backed up his feelings with actions. He lost a lot of roles. He turned down a lot of roles and tens of millions of dollars. And I can at least say he puts his money where his mouth is. And regardless of my thoughts, I do admire him for that. Though I'm sure Universal was pissed as fuck.
Well, true. And that's all admirable, Adam. The problem is you've already done this movie. You actually follow through with this and then go back on your morals. You're affecting other actors in this production when you do shit like that. When you come out against it and you don't do any movies like this, that's fine. But the fact that he affected all these people, I lost a lot of respect for him around that time, because I'm like, dude, you are fucking up a lot of things. Although, we'll discuss this movie. I don't know if he was coming out against the movie's violence or the movie's content anyway, but I thought it was a real dickhead move.
I don't want to say I had his back, but having seen the movie and the way his character interacts with other people, I could kind of see his train of thought with why he accepted this role. And at least there is a certain consistency. It's not like he's the one with the biggest body count. He's not the Punisher, which this character very well could have been written to be. But I also said I have to reserve judgment until I see the movie, because he put those comments out like 2 months before the release. Mm-hmm. And this movie did takes as much of a beating as the protagonist did in the first movie. Unlike the first film, this one got some pretty harsh commentary. But out of nowhere, Mr. Quentin Tarantino came out and just sang this thing's praises to no end. I don't know if it was on Twitter or like Howard Stern. He did something where
he
said it was one of the 10 best movies he saw that year. I wanted to strangle him and say, did you only see two movies this year?
I swear, Quentin, sometimes I feel like, especially back then, it almost wants to Howard Stern himself and loves to hear himself talk and see his name in print. Quentin loves to hear himself talk. He really does.
Well, that's been since Reservoir Dogs. He's always been that
way. I know. And like I say, I love Quentin, but Jesus Christ, the dude, like, if he sees an opportunity to get himself some ink, he will not miss that chance. And I do think part of it was a reaction, because he aligns more with Mark Miller than he does with Jim Carrey. And I think it was a writer's kind of binding together kind of thing. But I don't know. Maybe Quentin Tarantino doing Hit Girl would pretty fucking pop me pretty good.
Well, he also loved the first one.
Mm-hmm. And Adam,
I don't remember his exact comments, but he sang that one's praises too.
And Adam, you're the one who said you could see Tarantino doing this. If he was going to do a comic book adaptation, this would probably be the one he would do. I can see his aesthetic and his sensibility would gravitate to it.
You look at Kill Bill and just think about it. Look at what he did with Lucy Liu's character that they had to animate. That's Hit Girl.
Yeah, except Quentin Tarantino actually knows how to direct.
When
a great soundtrack.
Went to see this, like I said, I was there to review it. I sat down and right away, I was already thinking about the age of Hit Girl, because it was at this screening that I saw my very first trailer for Carrie, which Grace Moretz was in later on that year. And right away in my head, without even seeing a trailer for this, I was like, how are they going to handle the fact that this girl has aged 2 years and is already like a teenager. I do think they had quite an uphill battle because she was such a precocious, groomed little girl last week, and here she is sprouting up, becoming a teenager, and 6 months away from being in a brand new version of one of King's biggest films. I had already had my doubts, and that cast more aspersions before this thing even started.
I almost didn't need to see the 2013 Carrie, because this could almost function as an adaptation of Carrie.
Oh, we'll talk about it. I have thoughts.
I was like, oh, I'm getting... she's made two versions of Carrie in the same year.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the movie then, because, yes, Matthew Vaughn did produce this, but he had little to no involvement, except for collecting the check. Although, not like this movie made $300 million.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much involvement did he have? Did he outline the story? Did he do anything here? I see Wadlow is actually, he's credited as being both the writer and director of this.
Yes, and he's the sole credited writer.
Yeah, so I'm sure he was there on meetings and things. But still, I can't see Vaughn after what last week's film was. And let's not forget, last week's film wasn't a hit either. That movie didn't really create a splash at the box office, but it was one of those things, and Adam mentioned this last week, it just kind of grew by word of mouth, which is something you cannot do anymore. If you get released now, you need to make a splash right away. It's going to be really, really tough for people to gather up steam and word of mouth, and that's exactly how the sequel was even made, was by word of mouth.
All right, well, right away is one of the immediate problems with this movie. We are told this takes place 4 years after the first one, mm-hmm. and commits maybe one of the biggest examples of the why now problem. Why do the things in this movie, from the villain to Hit Girl's new life, the fact that this takes place 4 years after makes me question everything and is a huge miscalculation.
Yeah, that was already a big mistake. Now, I haven't read the comics, so I can't tell you if they take place 4 years later, if they were just following what was there. But if I was having doubts before, the first few frames and the reintroduction of these characters did it for me. I was really casting my doubts as to if they were going to pull this off.
They only excuse it because of how much she's aged.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the only reason. But I also feel like they never really harp on it again. You think about it at the beginning, Matt, you hit it. Why now? Like, the rest of this makes no sense why it would be so detached time-wise from the film we just discussed. But based on that, I think you got a fundamental flaw. There's a star of this film, and it's not the title of the film.
Yes, although he does get put in the hit girl position because the movie opens with him getting shot with the bulletproof vest on.
Yeah. I actually thought that was a cute way to open. I'll throw that out there. I thought this was actually kind of clever.
The chronology notwithstanding, mm-hmm. I don't think this movie starts off on a bad note.
Yeah.
Because I feel like these are the same two characters, although it is distracting that even though it's 4 years later, it still feels like this should not be as far away as we're told. But he's still in high school, which, correct me if I'm wrong, shouldn't he be in college by now?
He should be graduated college.
Did you ever say how old he is in the first one?
I don't think they do.
No, but I thought he was a junior and she was a freshman, or he was a senior and she was a freshman. Like, no, it doesn't match.
No, it doesn't. And last week, Matt, you mentioned that he could have pulled last week off. He pulled off being a high schooler pretty well, even though he was already way past the high school age. Here, it's really worse than Adam's biggest example, which is 90210.
Well, what doesn't help is that despite the clothing, he is so much visibly more jacked it just adds to the borderline ridiculousness that he's supposed to be in high school. But he's basically retired, so we're dealing with this trope of the superhero no more. He's just trying to live a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, and this movie sets a record in this opening as we're getting reintroduced to all the characters. They brought everyone back, except Evan Peters' career was about to take off.
Yeah.
So he pulled a Quicksilver and ran the fuck away from this movie.
Him and the chick who played Kick-Ass's girlfriend, she was on American Horror Story around this time, so she wasn't available except for one little scene that we'll talk about. But I was shocked, actually, that they were able to bring back as many people as they were.
I say, though, at least Evan Peters was smart enough to follow Vaughn over to the X-Universe.
Yeah, and then Vaughn left him at the altar.
Yeah.
And left him with Bryan Singer, which is a scary thing, because Evan Peters seems like the type Bryan Singer would go after.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
No wonder why he played Dahmer.
Well, speaking of grooming, I have never seen a superhero movie throw the likable girlfriend under the bus like the opening of this movie does. She is portrayed as a stuck-up, like, immediately, not only does she think that he's cheating on her with a 15-year-old, which he seems like the nicest guy in the world and won't do that, but then she counters it by saying, oh, I was cheating on you, so fool me once, shame on you. This is borderline insulting, and I'm not going to call this movie misogynistic, but between this and the Hit Girl subplot and how that's handled, this feels very short-sighted.
This is exactly what I mentioned last week, where Vaughn was able to make every character, for the most part, very likable, the ones that he was supposed to. This feels so much more like the comic, where everybody is fucking despicable, especially this girl. This is how she is portrayed in that book. I mentioned that when she suspects him cheating in that book, she goes and she fucking has oral sex with his friends and brags to him about it. Here, she is portrayed in the exact same way, and my God, is Vaughn needed here. And I'm not the world's biggest Vaughn fan, as I mentioned last week. We'll eventually get to X-Men First Class. You know, I may fold my chair on that one, but I think with this, he is so needed because this chick is a complete 180. Yeah, she suspected last week, but it was something that felt genuine. This just feels mean-spirited and ungenuine. It's a terrible way to handle this character. But that's the way this movie is in general, is it is a bigger adaptation of that book, which tells me that maybe Millar had more of a hand in the creative aspects of this movie, because that's exactly how he portrays these characters in his book.
Yeah, I think he did too, and I think it's why he likes this, and he still talks about this movie.
Oh my God, does he?
Yeah, he does. Mark Millar thinks he's Frank Miller in the way that he depicts women, and I don't like it. I'm not saying there's not a place for it. It's kind of like The Boys. You know, there's time where it's a place for that kind of, and it's like, great. When it's all you can do, it's hard for me to get past that that's the way you look at women. I don't like it. I feel it's dirty. I feel it's uncomfortable because you don't show them in a positive light except for one. And it's just, I don't know. It's so unnecessary. It's hard to get past.
That's a very good way of describing it, unnecessary.
Look at every female character outside of Hit Girl. They're either portrayed as remarkably shallow, strictly a sex object, which is the case with Night Bitch, or overly butch with the Mother Russia character. There is no nuance with how the women are depicted, and the arc that Hit Girl has ends like a Saturday morning cartoon.
And if it wasn't for something edited out that is in the story, I think we'd be saying that she was treated the same way.
So I think right away this movie is, I'm going to say this a lot, the writing in this movie is what I was afraid the first movie was going to be. This one really feels like it was written by a 15-year-old boy. Not that Dave could pass for 15 at this point, but that's what Hit Girl is. And they did recast her adoptive father. It's Morris Chestnut this time around. And this guy is made also to look like a complete moron because she has been skipping school for 4 years. And it took him until now to figure this out?
Anybody that's a parent knows that you get those emails and automated phone calls right away. nice to see Morris Chestnut, though. I don't know what they pulled to get him in here.
They even try the whole Ferris Bueller thing of her getting home in time and getting in bed in costume, hoping that he doesn't see her as she's getting home right before he does and thinking that she's been home the entire time. It's weird. And it's weird seeing Morris Chestnut here as opposed to who we saw last week. For some reason, they couldn't bring that guy back. We'll talk more about Hit Girl as we go, but as it intros itself and we're seeing where her life has been in the, 4 years since, it's just kind of funny.
Yeah, and she's doing her best to live a double life, but Dave comes to her and says, I want to get back in the swing of things. Train me to be Batman and Robin, to which she says, nobody wants to be Robin. Tell that to the Warner Brothers people, because that's why they refuse to do him properly in a movie.
Tell that to Marlon Wayans.
So she reluctantly agrees to do so, and he does get his ass kicked, although she should have a career as a fitness instructor, because he gets himself into pretty good shape with minimal equipment or a diet.
And it is here that she starts realizing that she has a thing for him. She's just kind of like, yeah, I'm having feelings that I don't realize I had.
Which, with her aging up 4 years, you already skipped over the fact that she's gone through puberty and stuff.
If this was like 6 months to a year later and she was just about to hit it, this would be more logical. But again, the only reason this takes place as far after the first one as it does is to address her obvious aging. And there's no way you could have recast it.
No, with the impact she had, there was no way you could have recast this.
If you're someone else, though, they'll recast you, no problem.
Yeah, we'll get Morris Chestnut come in here.
Or Evan Peters.
Yeah. They didn't even try with the Evan Peters character.
No, he looks nothing like him.
I know.
They wrote him also to be just a dumbass. And yeah. He does something later on, which, like, if I was his friend, that's, like, unforgivable what he does later
yeah,
on.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, speaking of unforgivable, we cut to Chris, once again played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who's being homeschooled. And I guess between movies, he moved out of New York, because this looks like they're living in L.A. with him and his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And he, again, this is 4 years later, and he has not made a move on Kick-Ass. Like, it doesn't make any sense. The timeline of this movie makes everyone look stupid.
Very. Because the very end of the last film is, wait until they get a load of me. What, 4 years later? You had a four-year plan?
Yeah. This should have been, I'm going to use a wrestling term because it's our fucking website and I can do it. This should have been treated like ECW's first pay-per-view when they built up Taz and Sabu, where they did not have any physical confrontations. But Taz would go out every week and beat the fuck out of somebody and call out Sabu. You could have had Chris killing people, like putting out messages, trying to provoke Kick-Ass to come out of retirement. But he doesn't do that. He's done nothing.
Although, we have an animated opening that shows the last 4 years of what happened. Do it in a comic book style to really bring it into place.
Although it is here that they introduced the only new character that I actually really like. John Leguizamo's character, I really did enjoy. And I'm not a big John Leguizamo fan. Although when we get to John Wick, we'll talk more about that. I like him here. And I hated the fact that he doesn't last the film. I think he is a very enjoyable presence in this.
I can't believe I'm going to say it, but I agree. And I got issues with John Leguizamo outside of Spawn or Jesus. Romeo and Juliet.
Oh my God, dude. Look at what you're pulling
fantastic.
Out.
Fantastic. In that film. Ugh.
You could have at least seen Moulin Rouge and gotten on my good side.
Surprisingly, he's like an enjoyable character to watch in this.
Yeah.
He kind of also knows what is up. He knows the movie and he's not going so far over the top. I don't know. He's a welcome presence in it. He's Luis in the Ant-Man films. He's kind of fits right in.
Well, I never thought I would see a movie where John Leguizamo and Jim Carrey are the two most subdued actors. What fucking time zone have we entered? Because this is clearly not 1998, because this is not the Pest or the Ace Ventura era. These guys learned how to calm down. I like him. I wish he was in it more, because I think the two of them actually play off each other really well. He's like, so I'm basically your butler, because he calls him Alfred.
Yeah.
And he just keeps walking.
Well, it was one of my favorite scenes in the film, was that particular scene.
He's angry at his mom, and straight out of Final Destination 3, he inadvertently kills her with a tanning bed.
Yeah, what was this?
That's like a morbid joke. That actually works, because it reminds me of the mom dying from the aneurysm in the first movie.
I guess, but where they take it is so bizarre. It's like an Oedipus complex with him.
Well, this character also really suffers the most from the bad writing, because he gets the most monologuing, and almost none of it is funny. True. When he's not with Leguizamo.
Yeah, when he was his dad's son, and his dad was doing most of the work last week, and Plast was in the background, I thought it worked pretty well. Here, him being at the forefront and him taking this where he does, calling himself the motherfucker, I'm like, really, dude? You're going that far? That extreme? I don't think it's Plast's fault. I just think the writing is pretty bad where they take this character.
Yeah, he's not done any favors by the writer.
No.
I can't stand Superbad, right? This dude here, I don't know if he's done a movie that I like. And this movie, he's just despicable all the way through. And I get he's your villain. But you kind of got to have something to like, or something to have fun, something to joke around with. And they just made him as unlikable, as despicable, as uncomfortable as they could have possibly written him. And there's no joy in Mudville. This dude just fucking, he wet blankets the film every time he shows up.
I liked him in the Fright Night remake. I thought he was one of the only bright spots of that. But yeah. He'd done some things. But yeah, you're right. I think Matt and I kind of hit it where it's not really him as much as it's the writing as it portrays him that kind of betrays him in the long run.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's just, you know, when you can only play one character, that's all you ever got.
Well, the problem is he's portrayed as both too naive. He doesn't know what anal beads are. Yeah. As we'll find out. But he's too despicable to be quote-unquote redeemed at the end of the movie, so I don't think anything with his characterization works, and it's a one-note joke of overusing the vanity between his name and his band's name. And I think the only funny gag that they do with him is the racist names he gives all of his henchmen, and Leguizamo keeps calling him out on
it. Yeah,
I think that's generally really funny, but outside of that, I feel like it's just, it's attempting to just commentate on those people who function outside of reality and take things to the extreme, like those, I don't want to call them incels, but it's kind of a similar approach that they're taking, because he's cleaning out his mom's stuff, he finds the handguns, which I'm pretty sure I saw those in Romeo and Juliet. I think those and he takes a BDSM outfit, and that's what he makes a superhero costume out of, which I think there is some humor to be mined there, but it's also the shock value of whatever we can do to appeal to our quote-unquote target demographic, we're just going to throw in this movie.
Well, what is their target demographic?
They're trying to make this for, like, teenage boys.
Well, teenage boys, but then you have the Hit Girl plot, which is strictly rom-com shit. Like,
it's Mean Girls.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I think that the plot gets muddled, because they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. And look, last week wasn't a perfect film, as we all said. We gave it sevens, which is not the highest of scores, but it was enjoyable enough. Here, I'm not getting much joy, and I'm getting reintroduced to characters that I loved last week, and I'm not really liking what I'm seeing, with the exception of one, which we'll talk about here in a bit. But I was not liking where they were taking these characters. And this is exactly what I was afraid of when I went to see this movie, is, are they going to take these characters I really liked last week and do something terrible with them? Well, yeah, that's what we're kind of seeing.
Most of them they do, main character included, because he is really egging on Hit Girl to come back to his side for no other reason than he needs the recognition from his group.
Exactly.
So even he is repeatedly thrown under the bus and kind of unlikable and selfish. Not that it matters too much, because this movie has 8,000 characters, and the main one is, like, the least interesting of anybody.
Yeah, why make your title character this? Last week they integrated him so well with what was going on, because everything was on the outside, and he was the one who decided, well, why hasn't anybody put a costume on? And that was kind of the charm of it. Here there's no charm, because here we've seen him retire and say, I'm done, and then come back so many times. It means nothing when he goes to Hit Girl and he says, well, kind of train me to be a Robin. Well, you've kind of put your custom away too many times already. We don't care.
Well, also, he has the Ben Affleck Batman problem of, I'm just going to keep showing my hand of my identity to anybody who will listen. But he's given his first assignment by Hit Girl to dress as the whitest pimp you will ever see. And while he can hold his own in a fight, eventually he gets overwhelmed and Hit Girl comes to save the day. And here's where we get into the violence, because the first film, it's very matter of fact, fantastical, but it was at a time where Matthew Vaughn's style felt really new. Nowadays, he's beaten it into the ground with that kinetic type of action. This one, it's just gross and viscera, because they have no other... Wadlow can't bring any of his own style to how he shoots the action, so he just relies on blood.
The action in this is so lacking. Look, last week was all about escalation, right? Here, we don't even have that. Yeah, we get a huge final battle, which we'll get to, but I'm not feeling any of this action, which was the same last week. Last week, I wasn't feeling any of that action either, but eventually, I kind of warmed up to it. I don't warm up to anything here, and all this action, especially a car chase that we'll talk about, is really just bland.
Yeah, and I think I don't feel it's too far detached from last week. I didn't feel like last week was great. Its message and what it did meta-wise was really important. I didn't feel like a lot of the quality of the fights outside of what Hit Girl did, I didn't think was very memorable. However, here, because I don't care, because it feels detached, because it's separated time-wise, I don't like the motherfucker. Even the group he puts together just feels just very lazily done. What's the why? What's the what? Who and what am I supposed to care about other than just, hey, we threw something on screen for shock value? And I feel like that's all that this is really starting to be, is look at aren't we cool because we're cussing and spewing blood everywhere. Well, that doesn't make a good sequel to a movie that really broke down the comic book movie relationship.
And it no longer feels taboo, because in the 3 years since, we've had the game get changed completely with the Avengers and Man of Steel and even something like X-Men First Class. Like, we're getting more variants.
Dark Knight Rises.
And also, one of the things this movie really struggles with is the first one, it's not the real world as we think of it, but it's very stripped down. This one is so absurd that it crosses the line going from satire to, as I mentioned in the opening, they've become what they were setting up for jokes in the first one.
Yeah, it's its own series at this point, and that hurts it, for sure.
I don't feel like there's any attachment to reality with how these characters act, with the circumstances they're put in. Everything is just over the top. which the first one has, but it knew when to sort of pull back and sort of slap you in the face with reality. This one, the only thing it keeps slapping you with is, hey, isn't this cool? Or like, isn't that gross, with two words, sick stick, which we'll talk about later on. Oof. Now, I've mentioned the humor a lot, but one of the funniest gags, and I want to know how much money they paid Chuck Liddell for one thing.
Yes.
Where Chris is trying to become a fighter in his own right until he realizes the Batman rule of, wait, money is the best superpower. I'm just going to pay guys to beat people.
Yes.
I think it's actually pretty funny.
That's a good gag.
I forgot that Academy Award winner Daniel Kaluuya is in this fucking movie. He tells Don Gazzama, just find me some guys to go take down Kick-Ass, who runs into another superhero, Dr. Gravity, who we think is a physicist, and he has like a weapon that he claims is like a propulsor ray, but he goes, no, it's just a decked out baseball bat. So at least we're not doing pseudoscience, because I'm like, all right, you've already teased Chekhov's adrenaline earlier in this movie, which I think that's the most eye-rolling thing I've seen in a very long time, because I'm like, okay, you've left no ambiguity as to what this actually is or how it's going to play into the movie. And if you had this, why did he not use this in the first movie when he was all tied up and about to die?
It makes no fucking sense how this shit gets integrated in this. I felt the exact same way. I'm like, where is this coming from, and why wasn't it used last week if you had it?
Mindy kind of gets caught from her adopted guardian saying, you know, you got to live a normal life. I'm going to take you to a sleepover where we're introduced to, basically, this is Nancy Allen and company from Carrie. It's the freaking Mean Girls.
Exactly what it is.
Full confession.
Okay. And
anybody who knows me knows that I love this shit. I really like these types of stories. I like Mean Girls. There was a real fucking subgenre of movies about girls being mean to each other, and this plays off that. I have to say, I really like Hit Girl's plot here. I hate the fact that I do, but come on, when one of my top 10 movies is She's All That, this kind of shit kind of plays to me, and I kind of dug it. Although, again, it has an edge to it. But I do like how she's trying her best to integrate with these girls, and she just can't. She can't. They connect on one level that we'll talk about here in a bit, but she is so struggling to fit, and I kind of like that. I like that, you know, her godfather, whatever he is like, you got to fit in. She tries, and it's just not working. She's trying to put the Hit Girl persona behind her, and it's always with her. And I like this plot. I like the way it... Look, I'm not going to say I like the way it fully plays out, but I do like the instinct to do this with this character.
You should have said the end sync to do this, because they're...
Because as I'm watching this, my thought is, oh my god, they gave Garrett some Gilmore Girls type drama in this film.
Oh, fuck.
Wait, Adam, you didn't like this?
No. No, oh. I don't. I understand. Okay, I might as well surmise it right here. You got a problem in this movie, and that this movie is Kick-Ass too. You know how you fix it? You make this movie Hit Girl. You make this movie Hit Girl, you have a hit, and you don't do that, and you need to do that. But because this is Kick-Ass 2, this is like a C plot. This should be a B plot servicing her A plot, but that's not what it is. You make a Hit Girl movie, all of this changes. Because Chloe Grace Moretz is great in this. I think she's a big step above. I think she's bringing a lot more. I think her acting has gotten better. She can convey more. She's fucking fantastic. But this movie is preoccupied with being Kick-Ass, and that's its downfall.
It's amazing how overstuffed this movie feels, considering it's only 90-something minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, last week's movie was almost 2 hours. This one's about 95 minutes, and I gotta say, it kind of feels a little longer.
Because like, this one really feels like what it is, where they took multiple runs and just meshed them together to try to make one movie. This feels like something that should have been like a miniseries, where it's like 4 or 5 episodes. And the Hit Girl episode is all the stuff with her, and it's just a full straight 45 minutes to an hour. But it can't be that, because it's also a Kick-Ass movie, because we're introduced to the other vigilante group, which is consistent with the first one, that of course, like Batman Begins, there would be escalation. Other superheroes are coming out of the woodwork. And we're introduced to Colonel Stars and Stripes, played by the aforementioned Jim Carrey, who leads Justice Forever. Now, despite Jim Carrey denouncing the movie after it came out, I kind of wish he didn't do that, because he is far and away my favorite thing in it. I am Can I say something I never thought I would say? He buries all of his usual mannerisms. There's very little here. And they do an interesting makeup job where I don't know exactly what they did, but there's clearly some prosthetic job on his face. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is ridiculous because he made his career off being the rubber-faced man, so to speak. Accents on point. There is very little of what you think of with Jim Carrey in this performance. And I wish he was in the movie more.
Well, it makes you... what you just said decries the question. Why would you take a movie like this if you're not being recognizable at all? Maybe that's kind of the point of it, but like I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I didn't know this was Jim Carrey until after it was over, and I looked at the credits. Now, is Stars and Stripes, is that a take on Captain America?
Obviously.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I kind of liked him too. But he kind of disappears for portions, and I kind of forget about his presence during the film. But what I do see, I do like. I kind of wish they took his character a little further than they do.
Not only do I like him, once I realize it, because even after the first time he shows up, I'm like, was that Jim? Nah, must not have been. And the second time, I'm like, okay, it is. I like what he does. I think he's doing something kind of different. Shit, maybe one day we'll go, we'll do meta movies and we'll discuss the Truman Show. But I think he's... is more talented than he gets credit for a lot of times. I think he does a really good job, and he outshines Nicolas Cage by being a different character than Jim Carrey. Nick Cage last week was Nick Cage. Jim Carrey is doing it, but he's doing it by playing a role. I appreciated that. I think when he's there, there's depth to it. The problem, though, is I think that conflicts with the movie. I think there's a much better message to be told, and the rest of the movie isn't engaged and doesn't care about telling it. But I think Jim Carrey's pretty fucking fantastic.
Well, there was a time in Jim Carrey's career where he was taking himself way serious because he had done Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and all of a sudden he thought he could win an Oscar. So he does a movie by a guy that the three of us are going to discuss here in the next year or so. He did a movie by Frank Darabont called The Majestic, which was basically Oscar bait. I tried watching that on a plane one time and I fell asleep. And this was at a time when you didn't have everything at your disposal. You had what the plane offered you. I couldn't get through it. I've tried watching it like 2-3 times, never been able to get through it. I feel like he's kind of combining both his huge comic persona that he started with and his big time I'm an actor portion of his career into this role and trying to take it into a place that Adam said is different, but it leaves little impact on me because I don't feel like he's impacting these characters in any way. I just feel like he's being a portion of Jim Carrey that I guess works for this movie, but again, it questions why would he take it if he's this anonymous in it?
Because he's not the villain.
Yeah.
Because the obvious thing is make him the big bad.
That's where I thought they were taking it, which they obviously don't. Yeah.
Which is, they should have done.
Yeah. And that's my argument, is they should have. If you have an actor like Jim Carrey accept this, I mean, yeah, his name didn't mean as much in 2013 than it did in 1997, but it still was a big get for them. Like, Nicolas Cage was a get for them. Why not take it in a place that's memorable? And Adam, I completely disagree with you, dude. I think Nicolas Cage left a pretty big impact because of the way he impacted the Hit Girl character. The Jim Carrey character leaves no impression on me because I don't see anybody being impacted by what he does. So it's kind of a waste for me to have Jim Carrey and use him like this.
Well, I don't think it's a waste because not only is it different from a performance standpoint, how many movies has Jim Carrey played a supporting role in? In his heyday, he led every single movie. You could argue, yeah, he's third billed in Batman Forever, but he's probably got the most screen time.
But that's what I said. Why would you take it if you're just like the fourth or fifth?
I think it's something, something different. You're talking about a guy who's pushing 50, and yeah, at this point, probably would have been 50. Something different. And also, in a lot of ways, though, this character could have been one of his recurring roles on In Living Color.
Yes. Yeah, I thought of Fire Marshal Bill doing
sure.
this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he doesn't do the Mike Myers thing where he's annoying. This isn't Eddie Murphy in the Nutty Professor movies where he felt the need to play every single character so exaggerated. I'm just surprised that there's not that moment where he loses his shit, which surprised me. Yeah. And I can see why he took this role and also denounced the violence because, as we find out, his character puts on a face, but not only is he a born-again Christian, which I find hysterical, the gun he carries has blanks in it. Mm-hmm. You never see him actually kill anybody. It's the Batman rule where he will maim them or even castrate them, but he's not going to kill them. He's leading this group of Justice Forever, which includes Dave's friend Clark, who, because he doesn't have a tragic origin like everyone else, he just repeats Batman's, but nobody realizes that's Batman's origin.
In a movie that I get very little joy out of, this made me laugh my ass off. this is the kind of stuff that the first one did so well. I really enjoyed what they do with this character in this movie. If you're going to integrate him in, this is the way to do it, man. I laugh so hard at this.
And again, he's terrible at keeping his identity a secret because yes. He not only blows his friend's cover, but he blows his own in front of everybody who yes. he's just met. I'm like, you are way too trusting. But he realizes that this group are not out there necessarily fighting crime and stuff. They're doing like soup kitchen stuff and feeding the homeless. And they look at it more as community service than actual like vigilantism. But the problem is they also mentioned Jim Carrey's character was an ex-mafia. Yeah. And he was tied into the Mark Strong family. But that connection is not made until he's killed off, which is a huge missed opportunity. Like, the only reason the motherfucker connects the through line is because he sees them on, like, Facebook. Not the fact that he recognizes them, because things in this movie only happen because the script requires it happens.
That's a good point. And if you're going to put him in this movie and kind of tie it into the first, that's the way to do it, right? You do it with the villains of the last film. And when you find out about it later, it kind of doesn't even leave any impact because you're like, okay, so why is he here if he's a born-again Christian yet part of the mafia? It's too jumbled a character to even work.
And Kick-Ass, because he's now single, hooks up with Night Bitch, which, I mean, that name should tell you everything that they feel about how the women are treated in this movie. Do we even learn her actual name?
I don't think so. I do remember this being a part of the aftermath of this film as well, where in the comic book, motherfucker rapes Night Bitch, and Ms. Platts was on record as saying, thank God they nixed that plot. They invade her house, they scare her, but they don't do what they do to her in that book, and God, I'm glad they didn't.
Well, speaking of dark, they do some actual crime fighting and bust open a sex trafficking operation. I mean, speaking of Marvel people, Benedict Wong is in this movie, which I really so we got one guy from Black Panther, we got one guy from Doctor Strange, we got the other Quicksilver.
Yes.
We got it a little bit the worst Bruce Wayne we have ever seen on screen. I do like that he names his dog Eisenhower because Ike and Dick. I can't believe I'm actually giving this movie's quote-unquote humor any semblance of credit, but I think that's actually amusing. But Mindy is also trying to live a normal life by trying out for the dance team, which goes very well because she imagines she is fighting a bunch of people, but nobody is put off by that they're watching a glorified karate demonstration.
I loved it. I love the impact it had on her quote-unquote main villain in this subplot. Like, she is just disgusted by what she's seeing because she's being outshined. Again, this is the stuff I liked in this movie. I'm sorry.
I'm just gonna move on.
All right.
So all is seemingly going well until the motherfucker realizes that Kick-Ass has resurfaced. He says, I gotta put a team together. So this is where we get the South Park Hall of Racist Stereotypes with Black Death, Genghis Carnage. I think that's actually that's pretty clever. Mother Russia, who looks like a cross between Dolph Lundgren and Bridget Nielsen.
I thought it was going to be Bridget Nielsen. I thought they were going to be smart enough to make it Bridget Nielsen. Then I realized that at that point she was doing Flavor of Love, and that was not the Bridget Nielsen we've come to know, but...
You thought they were going to go Bridget Nielsen. God damn
it. If you do it at this point, you actually go ahead and make that joke full-fleshed out. It's not like this movie is subtle in any possible way.
Yeah, not at all. But he puts his team together, and I'm going to call them TMC, because I'm not saying that on the airwaves multiple times. Because the first movie caught enough flack. It's almost like they said, oh yeah, we got criticized for using that word once in the first movie. We're just going to say that as many times as we can.
Yeah, they're going to quadruple it. They say it like four times. Yeah. Which tells you that they did not have their heads straight when they put this movie together. Because if that's what you're going to do, is you're just going to quadruple up on what made last week's film so shocking, that's not what people liked about that movie. What they liked about it was the way these characters resemble what we've seen before, yet have their own little story going on. And these don't resemble anything we saw, even last week, and yet you're having them say the thing that got parents in an uproar last week. But here's the problem. At this point, these characters have aged, so it's not shocking anymore. They really missed the boat on that.
Yeah, so Chris goes to see his uncle, who I don't think is ever mentioned in the first movie.
I don't think he is either.
And anytime I see Ian Glenn in a movie, my eyes just glaze over, because I think the guy is just a black hole of charisma. Even as a mafia boss, he's not imposing. I guess John Leguizamo, they only had him for 2 days, so they kill him off in the car. That's supposed to be like what sets him over the edge, I guess, but he's already killed his mother, so how am I supposed to have sympathy for his butler getting killed that he's only just started working with?
And I really thought what we were going to get, I thought they were going to kill motherfucker and John Leguizamo was going to take over everything. I felt that was a natural way this was going, as a way to subvert our expectations. But this, I don't, this screen has no interest in giving us what we don't think we're getting. It's written by 12-year-old boys at a sleepover.
So, Adam, this is your first time watching this, as we established. You'd never seen this before. How are you feeling at this point? Are you feeling any of the joy you felt last week?
Yeah, from time to time. I'm going to say, I don't think this movie's too far removed from last week, but the lows are really low. And I think that's the problem. Again, this movie has no business being anything but a hit girl film, because the rest of it is a dreck.
Even the Jim Carrey stuff we discussed, you weren't liking that as well.
I do enjoy him. I think he steals the show from the ones around him, from the group around him. I think he actually does a good job. I like that character and what it means. But otherwise, you know what? I like seeing Turk from Scrubs on here being a hero, you know, but other than that, thank God this movie only cost $28 million.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure 10 of that went to Jim Carrey.
Yeah, right.
Probably.
I don't see anyone else in this movie commanding a big salary.
It definitely didn't go to blue screen. We'll talk about it.
We'll get there, but
yep.
So they go to Jim Carrey's house and kill him, which I will give the movie credit. I didn't expect that because I don't know if that comic. Because by this point, I was bored out of my mind. And this kind of woke me back up because it was something unexpected. But because I don't find anyone else remotely interesting, this is kind of the line of demarcation where the rest of this movie I find pretty interminable.
It's amazing for such a short movie how long this movie is.
Yeah, that's what I said earlier. Last week's film was almost 2 hours. This one's 95 minutes. It feels the other way around. Yeah, I liked the subversion of killing Jim Carrey's character. I thought that was, as you said, it was very shocking. But when Nicolas Cage died last week, when Big Daddy died last week, it impacted the hit girl character. This character dies, and it doesn't really feel like it has an impact. And that's the thing. They're killing him just to kill him and to say, you didn't see that coming. Well, have it have an impact one way or another. It doesn't feel like it has any sort of impact, and that something that should be well regarded for the film overall doesn't have any lasting impact because we don't care.
Well, speaking of not caring, you mentioned that they removed the rape scene, but he still attempts to do it because they go to her house, and the only reason they don't is because he can't get it up.
Yeah, but here's the thing. They turned it into a joke in this, whereas in the comic, he actually goes through with it. So, but still, you guys have said this feels like it was written by 15-year-old boys, and that is a 15-year-old boy joke. So it's like, yeah, you turn it into a comedy bit instead.
Just really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's bad. Well, I mean, it's got to be better just on its surface, but I'm not saying it's a better choice. You just eliminate it. I mean, I guess you could say that he's as impotent as Mark Muller's writing. Put that on my poster.
And this movie has never really, I never felt like they were directly lifting from other movies, but this Mother Russia sequence where she kills all these cops. Adam, was I the only one thinking of X-Men 2 when Pyro kills all those cops?
My God, it might as well have even be shot on the same street. I think that's the same cul-de-sac at Universal.
Like, it's that same scene, just with more blood.
Well, really bad CG blood, too.
Those fucking morons, like, they see the lawnmower, and they're like, oh, what is that? Apparently, in this universe, all the cops are complete morons.
Well, if there was one thing Kick-Ass 1 was missing, was a big bad. And if you're going to make a big bad, this is kind of the way to do it, I guess. You know, you're going to get somebody imposing. But as Matt mentioned, it's kind of a joke because it's a huge female bodybuilder that I kind of like this because, again, you got the muscle here. You got the person who is going to be your final battle. You're giving somebody that you're going to give to Hit Girl here. But it's still turned more into a joke than anything.
Well, I feel like she's only here to give Hit Girl someone to fight.
Exactly.
Because even the first one caught a lot of controversy with Mark Strong physically assaulting her. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to run into that quote-unquote controversy. I call it a non-troversy. at this point. But from here, the police do a clampdown on vigilantes, so they start arresting anybody with a mask. They go full Watchmen at this point. In the midst of all this, Dave gets found out.
Oh, by the way, we have the Kick-Ass character here.
Yeah. Like, they should have called this movie Hit Girl Part 2.
Yeah.
Featuring Kick-Ass.
You completely forget that he's even in this movie.
So his dad finds the costume, and because of this, he willingly gives himself up to cover for him. And they want this so desperately to have emotional resonance, but Aaron Taylor-Johnson is checked out of this movie. I think because he knew he was not going to be the focal point, he just phoned it in, because he's pretty bad at this, and I see why Adam has such resentment towards him between this and Godzilla.
Damn it, it took away my Godzilla compare.
Look, he's just not in this movie enough to have any I keep saying lasting impact. I'd come up with another metaphor, but he just doesn't really resonate because he's hardly in this. And when he is, it's not even part of a plot. He just kind of integrates himself. And that's not what you do with a movie called Kick-Ass. I almost said
you movie, did it too.
I almost said a movie called Hit Girl because that's pretty much what this movie is. But all right, Adam, unleash on Aaron Taylor Johnson here.
Thank goodness, you know, that we got such a wonderful actor to become Kraven and so many other astounding comic book. I like this moment, but yeah, to your point, because he hasn't been the focus, it doesn't hit where it should. Mm-hmm. And this father-son moment, it should matter. This sacrifice should matter. But this movie's preoccupied with, I got to assume, is just a writer's room of guys sitting around smoking weed and drinking and just sticking their thumbs up their ass, telling each other what they wrote is great. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody needed to stop and say, hey, we have a potential to make a good movie, and they weren't interested in doing that.
Well, it's so hard to make a sequel to satire, and that's what last week's movie was, in essence, was a satire on comic book films that turned into something that people remembered because of the way Hit Girl was portrayed. But when you make a sequel to satire, it's so hard to amp everything up. Plus, you have a comic book story to tell. I mean, let's not forget, this is part of a comic book franchise. This is part of our comic book retrospective. This should feel like a comic. And with all these characters being so unlikable, it just goes from panel to panel for me just waiting for something to have an impact, which it never does.
Well, part of it is also this. I feel like no one in this movie has a brain, because I also skipped over Todd, the friend, being rejected and outing Kick-Ass and his dad to the motherfucker in his lair, which I don't care how pissed you would be. Nobody's that naive. There's no repercussions for that. It's just, oh, I forgive you. And the movie moves on. And speaking of revenge, so Hit Girl gets stood up on a quote unquote date, and she takes matters into her own hands at lunchtime by dressing like all the popular girls do. And again, this is more fuel to my fire that she was miscast as Carrie because she's too pretty to possibly be Carrie, which we talked about. But she gets the last laugh with the six stick in the most uncomfortable puking scene I have watched in a movie. Like, not since Trainspotting have I been this grossed out by bodily fluids.
Yeah, and they double up on it because not only does it make them throw up, but she shits while she wears this dress, and you have CGI fucking pudding on screen. It looked really bad, but it is kind of the over-the-topness that we expect from this franchise, but this even went a little too far because it's not funny, number one. Number two, it's tough to watch. You skipped over the fact that we think her awakening is her seeing Kick-Ass earlier, but then she watches this boy band video.
It's obviously supposed to be One Direction because one of them looks too much like Harry Styles.
Well, here's the thing. That is a real band. They were yes, it is a real band. I looked it up. These guys had album after album. They broke up, I think, in like 2018, maybe. But they were real. Why you would agree to be portrayed like this is beyond me, because they are a flat-out joke in this movie. And it leads up to this moment, and this moment is, it's not funny. I didn't laugh. I didn't think it was a awakening of the Hit Girl character. I think it was just a way to put these girls off in a Mean Girl style.
And we now know what kind of music Garrett was listening to for quote-unquote research purposes.
No, to be fair, I did not listen to any of the songs.
You just outed yourself on these airwaves. That's going on the bloopers.
To be fair, I didn't listen to their music. What I did was say, okay, there's no way a band would agree to be portrayed like this. And sure as shit, they must have had a manager that was desperate for attention, because that's exactly what happened.
I don't know. Everybody needs to eat. And that's true. As the Million Dollar Man said, everybody's got a price.
Yep.
Now they're really checking off the tropes, because Dave's dad gets killed in prison. And they do the cliche thing at the funeral. But the funeral gets attacked. Dave gets kidnapped, and Hit Girl goes to save him with a green screen budget that you would find in a Geico commercial. This is inexcusable.
Yeah, this is so bad. Geico commercial. Nice comparison. Yeah, that's exactly what this feels like. Look, we haven't had an action scene for a while, but Wadlow, not only can he not direct horror, he can't direct action either. This is so badly done. You said they have a budget of $30 million, $29
million? $28.
$28. God, they must have spent it all on Jim Carrey, because this is about 1.5 here, if that. Yeah, this is pretty bad. And I don't know if it's because Grace Moretz didn't want to do any of the action or whatever, and she was checked out as well as Aaron Taylor Johnson was, but this is terrible.
It's just a shame, because that was a lot of what stuck around for the first one. And I can't really say reshoots, because nothing is differentiated between tones or styles. It's just poor. It's a shame, because I do think there's potential here, and every bit of it is squandered. for somebody's fucking buying themselves a new boat or something along the lines.
It's the opposite. You know how in the Wolverine, there's that fight on the bullet train, and it looked really bad in the trailer, but they clearly did some post work and fixed it. This looks like the trailer footage, and they just said, fuck it, it's good enough.
Yeah, Jim Carrey needed a Sonic this movie as well.
It just feels like they're getting through it. They're getting through it because they have their background star, which actually is their main star for a series of weeks before she goes on to film Carrie. And so they're trying to fit it all in. And look, it's tough making any movie, but I don't feel like there's any real heart being put into this like there was last week, because they're resting on the laurels of us loving last week's characters. And the thing is, last week's characters, they aren't the same characters at this point. And so it feels like they're just getting through it.
Well, speaking of not feeling like the same characters, they do quote unquote reconcile, and they get an army of do-gooders, which comes out of nowhere because their society is like six people. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now there's like 50.
Somehow superheroes returned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's feeling even further divorced from reality. It's like the money went to the villain lair and the superhero cave and nowhere else in the production department. I will say, I do find the shark gag pretty amusing.
I do too.
I think it's dead. Stop moving.
Yeah, I do too. I found that amusing as well.
Because that is a whole thing. Like, I know it's not a great white, but that's why aquariums can't keep sharks, is just because they have to swim so much and all that. So as practical as you think it would be, I mean, look, Austin Powers made a joke out of this with laser beams on their heads.
And let's not forget where it came from, Matt. It came from Bond. This is a straight Bond reference.
Oh, yeah. This is the Piranha tank from You Only Live Twice, which this movie needed a second life in the writing.
Yes.
This movie the writer needed to inject himself with adrenaline to finish. Because we get the big fight, which is, it's about as well shot as the fight scene in Anchorman. And I don't say that as a compliment, because the difference is Anchorman, that was meant to be ridiculous and funny. The last 30 minutes of this movie, I think, just suck.
I think there's some fun things here. I think the fight's okay, but you're right. It's not really shot in an exciting way. By the time it's over, it's like, oh, it's over. Like, it's just there and it's passing by because we have villains and we have heroes and we have to have them fight at the end. But it is over the top. And I thought of Anchorman 2 as well. Again, last week's movie was such a, I keep complimenting it like it was like a great, great movie, which it wasn't, but it was at least amusing. And here I'm not finding any amusement.
My issue here with this fight at the end, you got all these people showing up. We don't know 90% of them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other problem.
We know like six of these people. I like the fight with Hit Girl and you know, the Russian chick. I think there's some cool stuff there. I like some of this, but the rest of it, I'm like, okay, you're going through the motions. I don't think it necessarily looks bad compared to the rest of this film, but it doesn't look good.
Well, I also think the Hit Girl Mother Russia fight, first of all, I thought The Dark Knight Returns got away with a lot with the Russian there with her boobs painted with the hammer and sickle. This is pretty close to that as far as...
Yeah, I kind of felt like it was doing from that second issue, of The Dark Knight Returns. I felt like that's what we were getting here with her. And everything but putting the swastika nipples.
Yeah, the swastika nipples. But in Soviet Russia, adrenaline saves you because there's no surprise here. Freaking Stevie Wonder could have seen this coming with how this happens. And, you know, like, this is straight out of Mortal Kombat with all the glass. Like, I have expected her to, like, rip apart and just be broken up into pieces and have the word fatality show up.
Yeah, everything is telegraphed here. There is nothing where you're just not seeing it 10 minutes before it actually completes.
There is also the fight with Chris and Dave where he falls through the skylight and he tells them, this is real life. There's no sequel, which I don't find amusing. Much like most of this movie.
Nope. It's like that one moment in the previous film where he's talking to the audience and Kick-Ass just says, haven't you seen American Beauty? You think I live till the end? Like, it's calling attention to itself. And that's a big reason why I hate Deadpool, is because that's 90 minutes of that. And yeah, this was not amusing to me. Although him falling in the shark tank, as I mentioned, is actually pretty amusing to me. Putting exclamation point on something that doesn't need it.
Yeah, we'll come back to that for the post-credit scene.
Oh, that's right.
The day is saved and everyone decides, all right, we're done. So we're hanging up our capes again. Mindy decides to leave because she's wanted for murder, even though her guardian could just cover for her. It's the ending of the Batman.
Do you think Matt Reeves took from this?
That's a bike and leaves. But what's worse, he's made even more unlikable because he seemingly continues on without her knowing that he's not just using her lair, but is going to continue to use the Big Daddy outfit.
So weird.
Like, it's really weird. Like, I don't really find him all that likable in this at all.
No, not at all.
No. And he's stupid throughout.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's supposed to detect. But
oof. She's like, the citizens need kick-ass. I'm like, why? There's no more. The whole point of this movie is everyone realized superheroics belong in comics. Because everyone else retires. The villains stop. Why is he continuing?
This movie didn't need kick-ass. Believe me, the community doesn't.
So he starts his own Bruce Wayne training regiment because he's fucking ripped as shit. I'll give him that. He put the work in. Mm-hmm. I just wish he put as much work into his line reads as he did into the gym.
Well, let's be honest. I wish there were as many reps by the writers as there was by Aaron Taylor Johnson here.
Well, that does it for Kick-Ass 2, although the post-credit scene is ripped off from Daredevil, where he's revealed to have survived and has been his dick bitten off by a shark.
Yep.
Which is
shit. Yeah. There was a post credit.
Yeah,
it's revealed he survived and he's in a hospital bed and he's got like no legs, no arms. He got his dick bitten off by a shark because, like I said, 15-year-old boy wrote the script apparently.
Yeah, and was listening to Metallica's One while they did it. Okay,
no, it would have been Saint Anger. Let's be honest, because a lot of people still think the album is actually good. All right, well, that does it for Kick-Ass 2, a movie that really does not live up to its namesake, or does it? On a scale of 1 to 10, Adam, what do you give Kick-Ass 2?
You know what? There was a joke in the first one about, you know what? How about ass kick? I feel like I got my ass kicked sitting down to watch this sequel. The first one's not a great movie, but it is a pretty great paper and dissertation on comic books and superheroes and in media and a lot of that stuff. And that's all missing here. I feel like there's multiple writers and none of them are gelling other than with some frat boy humor that doesn't work. And yes, comedy is subjective. It's why we don't really discuss comedies, but it's irreverent in a way that doesn't complement the story. You just got random shit thrown about. You think that the more you cuss or the more you can try to be extreme in what you're saying is, I mean, look, Rob Liefeld must love this movie because it is just extreme to the max in the jokes it's telling and the blood it's telling. It's a shithole through and through. It kind of just disregards and ignores what made that first film and presumably comic, like say I haven't read it and this movie series doesn't make me want to, but it throws out that thoughtful dissertation of media. Jim Carrey, I think, really does a pretty fantastic job here. I like what he brings. I like that thought process between it. The rest of it goes okay, but this really, really should have been a showcase for Chloe Grace Moretz because when she's on the screen, she steals the show. This is Hit Girl's movie. The problem is it's not Hit Girl. And I think if this was rewritten for that, you would have had a success. You would have had a hit. Instead, we all got our asses kicked by watching this film. It's, I guess if you want it as a background watch to say you watched them both, feel free. I'm going to give it my buddy's GC 4/10 because I do think Chloe Grace Moretz is great in this film. I think she actually improves. I think she's great. I think Jim Carrey does a damn good job. John Leguizamo is enjoyable to watch, but you could skip this film and be pleasantly better off for it. 4/10.
Yeah, and to Adam's point, this movie is so quote unquote extreme, it might as well have a Mountain Dew logo attached to it. Garrett, what say you? You know, the man who I've learned much more about you on this particular show than I ever wanted.
Between this and Superman 3.
So I'm really curious to know what you think.
I can listen to Adam say John Leguizamo all damn day. As far as this goes, look, if people, after I mentioned last week, have gone back and read my review on Letterboxd about Kick-Ass 2, it's pretty much my same exact feelings. I thought maybe coming back after over 10 years away would kind of warm me up to it. And it kind of did when it came to the Hit Girl subplot, even though it ended terribly. That's the exact way to describe this movie. It just ended terribly. I feel like these guys came back and what this movie illustrates to me is something that I did not give Matthew Vaughn enough credit for, which is his presence, his way of handling these characters made them so much better than they actually are. And the fact that Vaughn isn't here, I don't think I've ever felt the non-presence of a previous director than I did watching Kick-Ass 2. Jeff Wadlow, you came from the bloodline of Katie Couric. We're not expecting you to have too much talent. You may be a good director in some ways. You may be a good music video director. There was a reason you were picked to be the successor to Matthew Vaughn in Kick-Ass 2. It just doesn't work. Jim Carrey, as much as he's denounced this movie, I can't say I disagree with him. However, I don't really feel his presence in this as well. This movie just kind of goes by. It's got shitty action scenes. It's got a non-plot of a title character, and it has some pretty unlikable shit. So yeah, I gotta go the exact same as Adam. I'm giving this a 4. That's mostly because of the Hit Girl subplot. I am pretty down on Kick-Ass 2.
I feel like we need a pop gun to shoot off, because for the first time ever, we have 2 weeks in a row where we all have the exact same score.
Last week,
we all gave Kick-Ass a 7, and this week we're all giving Kick-Ass 2 a 4, because that's what I have written down. So to quote one of my favorite TV shows of all time, I love you, but you are not serious people. I feel like that's what Matthew Vaughn said when he finally watched this movie. His handpicked successor, which... I'm quoting Succession for those of you who don't know, which is also why I use that word, is that this goes to show the importance of how a steadfast director can elevate good material, but a workman director cannot elevate subpar material. I'm not saying this would have been a masterpiece if Matthew Vaughn directed it, because, well, we'll talk about that in a couple weeks. But even as it stands, this is just an inferior product across the board. The only positives I can say are what you guys mentioned. I think the Hit Girl stuff, as tropey as it is, and like those types of movies that Garrett idolizes, I have no use for them personally.
I never said idolized.
You know, look, I'm the guy who loves 10 Things I Hate About You, so I'm not one to talk. But 10 Things I Hate About You could apply to like the first 10, like the last 30 minutes of this film, because... from the moment Jim Carrey's killed off, my interest also bled out on the floor alongside him, because it's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but I don't find any enjoyment out of it, and I don't feel like it's reinventing the wheel or spinning the wheel in a way that the first one really benefited from doing. Because this one, it has shock value, and that's really all it has. There's really nothing else behind it, so I don't want to call it a waste of time, but I don't feel like it's a productive use of my time. So happy we reviewed it, but I'm kind of glad I don't have to watch this again. So 4 out of 10 for me. Well, boys, we're about to do a complete 180.
I was going to say, has there been a bigger turn of series of films than we're going to do? There's no two different movies than this one and the one we're about ready to discuss next week.
So before we go back to Matthew Vaughn, because we have some unfinished business with him and Mark Millar for that matter, we're going back to the mouse in a lot of ways.
Wait, before we do that, let me mention that, guys, there has been talk in the last couple years of a Kick-Ass 3. Grace Moretz has said she won't do it unless Vaughn comes back to direct it. Do you guys think there's any possibility we'll get that?
Well, is this where we drop the facade and put this out there? There is a third Kick-Ass movie coming out this year. Supposedly.
I haven't heard anything about it.
Stunt Nuts the movie.
Oh.
I don't know. Do you not know what this is?
I do. Yeah. So the title is already. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is it's supposed to be the first of a new series. It's set in that universe. I'll believe it when I see it, because we know who's in it, but there's been no advertising for it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a Kick-Ass 3 proper, no chance. It's been 10 years. Aaron Taylor-Johnson is on to bigger and better things, although I feel like the opposite has happened for Chloe Grace Moretz, unfortunately. I don't know where the hell she's been.
Yeah, what has gone on with her career?
You know, I thought she was going to be the next, like, I don't know, Jennifer Lawrence.
Honestly, I thought she was going to go the way of Brie Larson. I thought she was going to really have an impact with certain roles, but she hasn't done that. And I know it's the career choices she's made. I mentioned last week, the last thing I saw her in was this really weird movie about gremlins on a plane that she was in, which was pretty much a one-woman show, if you watch that movie. I hope she catches fire. Look, I hope she has kind of, I don't want to say comeback, but she's kind of disappeared from the limelight, probably for personal reasons. Maybe she's gotten married. Maybe she's happy. Maybe she doesn't need acting anymore. Maybe she graduated college. But yeah, I agree. I think the screen misses her.
I don't know. Maybe she... Well, I know she's married, or she's in a long-term relationship. I know she came out of the closet, which was a big thing.
Oh, did she? I didn't know that.
Yeah, she in a long-standing relationship with a woman.
Wow.
Because between Kick-Ass and Hugo, I thought she was going to be like a next big star. I thought she was really good in The Equalizer. She's not in it a lot, but...
Oh, that's right. She was in the first Equalizer.
She was the prostitute. Yeah, I think the last thing I saw her in was the Suspiria remake.
Yeah, I think that was the last thing they got a wide release. I think everything else has been streaming and little TV movies. So, you know what? Let her be the White Queen. Let her be Emma Frost when they reboot X-Men.
Oh, that's...
I thought you were talking about the Chronicles of Narnia. I know Greta Gerwig's doing that now. But yeah, so something that, much like Kick-Ass, a lot of people don't know is a Marvel property is Big Hero 6. Based on a Marvel book, we'll talk a little bit about the history when we get into the movie, but we'd be not doing our due diligence in the way Garrett defines it, his very strict definition, if we did not cover this. I saw it in theaters, but I have not gone back to it in the 10 years since.
Yeah, I did see this. I believe I saw it when it came to streaming, maybe. Maybe I saw it when it hit Redbox. I know I didn't go to theaters to see it, but I did see it because I had heard it was a tied into Marvel somehow, some way. So I have seen this, but like you, I haven't revisited it in 10 years, not for any reason. But I kind of remember liking it, but I don't remember much about it.
Are you kidding? I had a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old or 6-year-old. And damn right, this was a theater watch. This was a theater watch, and this was a lot of the toys that Christmas as well. So, yeah, Big Hero 6 played it's older at this point, but that year to 2 years after it came out, this was a staple in my house.
Wow, this was a toy line too, huh?
Yeah.
A Disney movie, you're shocked.
Well, I guess, yeah. I just don't remember it having much cultural impact is what I'm saying.
Well, we'll talk about its origins and all that once we get into that show. Because it's got a history that a lot of people don't know about, especially with where it technically started from.
Oh, can't wait to dive in.
So, boys, I really appreciate these kick-ass discussions. Although we kind of kicked the ass of this movie.
We sure did.
Kind of deserved it. Who knows? Maybe it'll stay down for the count and go to the hospital, go to rehab, and come back with something better. Until next week when we review Big Hero 6, you're going to pay for what you did to my dad. You blew up my dad with a podcast. Thank you, boys. I'm going to be risky.
Life is so like a party. I know what you're going to say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just going to tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Exit. Words to live by.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved. And no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Show's over, motherfuckers.
Okay, I felt terrible because I thought maybe I thought maybe you had to be there at five. So I was like, oh shit.
No, I always give myself a buffer, you know, just in case, you know. But nope. But it's one of those. It's not like we can switch days till tomorrow since it's a one night event.
So, so you're telling me that he's going to be introed by, let's get ready to rumble. Oh, no, that not that kind of buffer, I guess. No. I'm sorry.
If they're right, you apologize for that joke.
I got to put something in the bloopers for these. We starting with Kick-Ass 2?
If they never made one, I would not have felt like I was missing out on some thing I was dying to go see.
Yeah,
I agree. I think this.
Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, there was a time in Jim Carrey's career where he was taking himself way serious because he had done what the hell was the name of the one he did with Kate Winslet? Damn it.
The Majestic?
No.
Eternal Sunshine.
Yes. He had done Eternal Sunshine.
And anytime I see Ian Glenn in a movie, my eyes just glaze over because I think the guy is just a black hole of charisma. Even as a mafia boss, he's not imposing.
What else has this guy been in?
Let's see. He was Bruce Wayne on Titans. He was on Game of Thrones. He was in...
That was the Bruce Wayne you were referring to. Okay.
He was in one of the Resident Evil movies. I think it was the third one.
It was one of the last... Yeah, he's like the doctor. Oh, God.
I knew Adam would know. He loves those fucking movies.
He's the doctor in the third one who comes back somehow in the last one as a clone.
You know, he walks alongside Khaleesi for like six seasons. That's who he is.
Yeah, he took the screen time that they're like, oh, shit, we really should not have killed off Jason Momoa. We should have killed off him instead. But
I still can't believe he was Bruce Wayne. Oh God, Titans was horrible.
Yeah, I was like, what would possess you to think he'd be a good Batman? Like, what do you see in this guy, people?
Still bitter.
Well, speaking of bitter, I guess John Leguizamo, they only had him for, I don't know, everybody needs to eat. And as the Million Dollar Man said, everybody's got a price.
Yep. All right, Adam, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, move on.
All right.
Well, speaking of moving on,
And I don't know if it's because Grace Moretz didn't want to do any of the action or whatever, and she was checked out as well as Aaron Taylor-Johnson was, but this is terrible. Adam has nothing to say about this action scene.
It's just a shame because...
And I thought of Anchorman 2 as well. Again, last week's movie was such a... I keep complimenting it like it was like a great, great movie, which it wasn't, but it was at least amusing. And here, I'm not finding any amusement.
Yeah. I guess I got to go see Anchorman.
You never see.
Yeah, you're not missing much. Watch like 5 clips on YouTube, yeah. And that's all. Watch the Steve Carell bits. Not to go into Anchorman tangent. The problem with Anchorman is the main character. Everyone else is so much more interesting than Will Ferrell is.
So every clip and meme I've seen. So I've basically seen the movie already.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be fine, baby doll.